that is killing the peoples of these countries? Number two, will the West or some element of the West realize that they're losing and they have to regroup and reformulate a policy that actually adjusts to the new reality that we just have observed?
Thank you very much, Lawrence Freeman. Africa Affairs expert there from Baltimore, and Richard Mertens, a pleasure seeing you after a while, journalist and commentator there from Vienna. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
An Israeli airstrike hits Aleppo International Airport in Syria, causing damage to the runway and putting it out of service. A French politician says the planned ban on the wearing of abaya dresses by Muslim girls in schools proves the government's obsessive rejection of Muslims. Also in the headlines, thousands of people demonstrate in Niger's capital Niamey, calling for the French forces to leave their country. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Israel has launched a fresh air attack on Syria, this time targeting the international airport in the northwestern city of Aleppo. Syrian media, citing a military source, say the attack damaged the runway of the airport, putting it out of service. No casualties have been reported. Back in May, an Israeli airstrike on Aleppo International Airport wounded several civilians and soldiers. The facility was hit by a similar attack in March as well. The regime frequently hits the capital, Damascus, with its airstrikes also. Syria says the strikes violate its national sovereignty. It has repeatedly complained to the UN, urging the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned Israel against targeting its leaders, pledging a crushing response to any foolish act by the regime. Senior Hamas official Ismail Radwan issued the warning in response to threats by the Israeli Prime Minister. On Sunday, Benjamin Netanyahu threatened to assassinate the deputy head of Hamas's political bureau, Saleh al-Araoui. The movement also issued a separate statement describing Netanyahu's threat as empty remarks that will not intimidate the resistance. Hamas reaffirmed steadfastness of Palestinian people and the resistance leaders in their fight against the Israeli occupation. It said the resistance against Israel will continue until Palestinians achieve all of their rights and liberate Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. 9 years have passed since Israel's 2014 war on the Gaza Strip that left over 2,000 Palestinians dead. Human rights groups and families of victims are demanding that Israeli war criminals be held accountable for their crimes. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following story from Gaza.
In July 2014, Israeli forces waged an all-out war against the Gaza Strip. The war ended in late August. Israel's 50-day-long summer war claimed the lives of over 2,200 Palestinians and left over 500,000 more internally displaced. It also caused wanton and vast destruction in the tiny coastal territory. Years on, people are still grieving the loss of their loved ones and continue to demand justice.
We call on the international community to stand by the victims and their families. Israel must pay the price for its crimes. Israeli war criminals killed my brother, and I demand justice. We will never forget our loved ones, and we will never forgive their killers.
In addition to killing and maiming thousands of people, Israeli forces bombarded entire neighborhoods, including apartment buildings. After the 2014 war, the Israeli regime unleashed more wars and military aggressions on Gaza, including the 11-day war in 2021.
9 years after Israel waged a war on Gaza in 2014, victims are still waiting for justice. The International Criminal Court is still unable to bring Israeli war criminals to justice. Israel considers itself above international law, and that has encouraged it to wage more wars and commit more war crimes after the 2014 war.
Gaza, which is home to more than 2 million people, has been the subject of almost non-stop Israeli aggression since 2008.
This is the real time for the international community in order to act and to be on the side of the international law, the international humanitarian law, to get Israel accountable towards its grave violations, towards its crimes on humanity. What happened in 2014 must be reviewed, and to get Israel accountable towards what have been committed during this war and after and before.
Many here blame the Israeli violence against Palestinians on what they describe as an international conspiracy of silence.
Experts say the International Criminal Court must take concrete steps in order to end Tel Aviv's impunity and bring Israeli leaders to justice. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Libya's Government of National Unity has suspended Foreign Minister Najla Mangouche pending an investigation. This after reports said that Mangouche had met with Israel's Foreign Minister Eli Cohen in Italy last week. Libya's Foreign Ministry said Mangouche had rejected a meeting with Cohen, and what happened was a casual encounter. The ministry added that the interaction did not include any discussions, agreements, or consultations. It also reiterated Libya's rejection of any normalization with Israel, reaffirming the country's support for the Palestinian cause. Libya's High State Council has voiced its surprise at the reports, calling for those responsible to be held accountable. News of the meeting sparked protests in several Libyan cities. Protests erupted Sunday evening on the streets of Tripoli and its suburbs, and a sign of refusal of normalization with Israel. In the northwestern city of Zawiya, young people set Israeli flags on fire and waved the Palestinian flag. A French politician has denounced the government's planned ban on the wearing of abaya dresses by Muslim girls in schools, describing it as policing of clothing. The remarks were made by Clementine Autain, a member of France's left-wing opposition Unbowed Party. This after French Education Minister Gabriel Attal said the government violated the country's strict secular laws in education. Autain slammed Attal's announcement as unconstitutional, saying that it was symptomatic of the French government's obsessive rejection of Muslims. The ban is being pushed by the right and far-right figures, while the leftist politicians say it encroaches on civil liberties. Muslim girls in French schools are also banned from wearing the Islamic headscarf. As tensions remain high following a spat of Koran desecrations across Denmark and Sweden, Copenhagen has announced plans to totally outlaw the improper treatment of objects of significance to a religious community, namely the Quran, the Bible, and the Torah. Rob Carter has visited Copenhagen and brings us the reaction from the scene.
Amid widespread anger over the disturbing trend of Quran desecrations across Scandinavia, the Danish government has announced plans to criminalize public mistreatment of religious objects. The new laws would permit police to act if holy scriptures, including the Quran, the Bible, or the Torah, are physically violated.
The Danish authorities' promise to change the law has been well received by many Muslim onlookers. However, there is still a lot of concern surrounding the reasons behind why this decision may be implemented. The idea that Denmark is facing a major threat from the Muslim world, rather than, for example, admitting that that their freedom of speech argument is flawed, that is in itself suspect and could even be an indication or a message to the Muslim world that Denmark is not willing to adopt any responsibility for the vile desecrations and offence that have been caused. Rather, they're seeking to place blame once again on the Muslim community itself for the reasons behind this law change.
On Saturday, local Danish Muslims gathered in a show of strength to continue the pressure in hopes of the law change proposal becoming a reality. Danish coalition officials said they could enact the policy as soon as the end of the year if it is approved by Parliament. According to a draft of a bill published by the Danish Justice Ministry, those found guilty of mistreating an object with major religious significance could be fined or sentenced to up to 2 years in prison. Both Denmark and neighbouring Sweden have struggled to defend the West's free speech argument, finally wilting in the face of international condemnations. The Quran desecrations infuriated the Muslim world, sparking massive protests across the globe. Rather than owning up or apologising for their defence of hate speech, Denmark's leaders have said that the national security was the primary motivation for the ban. This was the excuse they've used for the law change. While some Muslims have been left disappointed with this reasoning, some celebrate the development as a victory in the war against Islamophobic hate speech. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Thousands of people have demonstrated in Niger's capital Niamey, calling on the French forces to leave the country.
I came here to demonstrate for the departure of French troops in Niger. That's what I came to demonstrate today. And they have to hear us. I know they hear us. Every day people come here to demonstrate. People are suffering and the ECOWAS wants to increase the sanctions even more. We are here. We will resist until death.
The protesters gathered near the French military base in the capital just a few hours before the deadline given to France's ambassador to leave Niger. On Friday, the country's foreign ministry gave a 48-hour ultimatum to the ambassador to leave. Similar demonstrations were held in support of Niger's military government on Friday and Saturday. France has some 1,500 soldiers based in the West African nation. It has dismissed the ultimatum, saying the military leaders have no authority to do so.
Tensions between Niamey and Paris are running high as Niger's military leaders have given the French ambassadors 48 hours to leave the country. In a statement, Niger's foreign minister said the decision to expel the French ambassador was taken partly due to their refusal to respond to an invitation to a meeting with Niger's Minister of Foreign Affairs. The statement added that actions by the French government have been contrary to the interests of the African nation. This prompted a response from France. Paris dismissed the ultimatum, saying Niger's junta have no authority to ask its ambassador to leave. The ultimatum was widely supported by Niger's public. Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the French military base in Niamey on Friday, calling for the departure of foreign troops.
It's all part of the general mobilization we have here. It's to demand the departure of these invading forces, this occupying force, the French force here at Niamey Air Base. That's why we want to come to the door of this base to ask them to leave our country from here. We don't need this occupying force. We don't want them on our land.
The latest development in Niger comes amid a series of anti-French demonstrations in the African country after the army overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum in July. The military leaders in Niamey accused former colonial power France of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. They also said the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is an organization in the pocket of France. This is because ECOWAS has imposed tough economic sanctions on Niger following the coup and has threatened the country with military intervention.
The region is employing other elements of its instruments and engaging with the military authorities. We are hopeful that these diplomatic efforts will yield the desired outcome and make it unnecessary for the deployment of the force. Nonetheless, preparations continue towards making the force ready for deployment.
Anti-French sentiment is high in several countries across the Sahel region. From Burkina Faso, Guinea and Mali to Niger, many Africans are blaming France for the growing insecurity in their countries. They also believe that Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on their economies.
The anger and resentment against ECOWAS and its threats to use military force against junta leaders in Niger comes as many across the Sahelian nation blame France for pushing the West African bloc to use military force in Niger. But the question, indeed, is that where is all that hatred against France coming from? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid the worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is, according to UN figures, considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public there points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all those grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across the sub-region, but reverberated across Europe and the United States. That's mainly due to the fact that Niger is home to strategic mineral reserves such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the US. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate will be waiting for many across the Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France and the United States, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they're the ones who should put an end to decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries.
The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has unveiled a homegrown radionuclide with applications in various fields. The radioisotope cesium-137 is produced by nuclear fission, can also be derived from nuclear waste. Gisumi Shahmedi explains.
Cesium-137, Iran's new solution for radioactive waste management and a leap forward in nuclear medicine, not to mention its many applications in industrial gauges. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran made the announcement while unveiling the homegrown radioisotope, which is currently produced at laboratory scales.
What's important to know is that cesium-137 itself is a strategically important product. With a half-life of about 30 years, it has various applications. It plays a key role in industrial gauges, for example, particularly in our oil and gas sector, and in order to measure the flow of fluids accurately. Also, for the calibration of industrial measuring tools, its long half-life is a great advantage. To that, I should add its various applications in nuclear medicine, in both diagnosing and treating cancer.
But most importantly, Iran now has a team of experts that are capable of recycling nuclear waste and producing radioisotopes while observing international standards and all the necessary regulations in accordance with IAEA safeguards. This becomes even more significant when taking into consideration a number of other radioisotopes found in nuclear waste, which can also be derived and applied in the sectors of healthcare, agriculture, and industry, as head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization explained.
It is essential that we have been able to meet the needs of our society as far as this type of state-of-the-art technology is concerned. We were able to do so as a member of the IAEA that complies with its regulations and safeguards.
Head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization added that Iran has now gained a foothold in this sector. He said not only will he be attending the upcoming IAEA General Conference in Vienna, but Iran will be holding its first exhibition there as well. The production of cesium-137 is the result of 6 months of hard work. But Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says it is not stopping there. And very soon we will be hearing more news about the production of more radioisotopes, particularly from nuclear waste. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Today is one of the hot days of summer. Let me turn on the air conditioner. Great. In Iran, every house has an air conditioner to alleviate the heat during the summer. However, long before air conditioning, and even long before electricity, Iranian architects found a very clever way to cool off. Yes, Iranians invented those ingeniously made wind catchers. You know what exactly they are? Today I'm going to take a trip to Yazd, known as the city of wind catchers. So, if you're interested in Iranian wind catchers, don't miss the trip. Wind catchers are a traditional Iranian architectural design that creates natural ventilation in buildings. The basic design consists of a tower that rises from a building below with openings at the top. Many old buildings in Yazd province, central Iran, were built with magnificent wind catchers. Wind catchers work in one of three ways. The most common way is to cool the inside of a building. The tower has openings that face the wind and catch it, creating airflow inside the structure. When used in combination with a conduit, air is drawn down into the conduit tunnel and comes in contact with the cooler earth and cold water. The cold air is drawn up through the wind catcher, which faces away from the prevailing wind, not only creating airflow, but also cooling the air. In a windless environment, wind catchers operate like a solar chimney, allowing hot air, which is lighter, to flow upwards and escape out the top of the tower. Combined with thick adobe walls, wind catchers are surprisingly effective and able to chill lower-level spaces. Wow! Yazd has a unique Iranian architecture. Look at the alleys. Brilliant. Dazzling. Well, before I totally get overwhelmed by the beauty of Yazd architecture, let me tell you what I have decided to do. Well, I was wondering if I could visit the Dolatabad Garden in Yazd. You know why? Because the tallest existing wind catcher is there. Okay, why not? Let me find it in the map. The Dolatabad Garden is located in Chahar Minar Quarter in Yazd. Not a long way to go. Here it is. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome all of you to Dolatabad Garden, where the tallest wind catcher in the world exists. Well, as far as I know, this garden was built more than 250 years ago. Here we enter the garden. Look at it. The garden is a masterpiece itself. Wow, look at the greenery. And the fountains which pass through the land. Beautiful. Gorgeous. These items were made in order to lessen the heat, of course. You can call it a gem in the heart of the desert. And the story was about this masterpiece of architecture. Yes, the wind catcher, or the tallest Adobe wind catcher in the world. It's proudly rising from a mansion in the garden. Oh, it's about 34 meters tall. It's a captivating structure. This wind catcher is octagonal, which lets wind flow from any direction into the building. On the other hand, there is a pond located under the internal deflector of this wind catcher to cool down the interior space. By combining wind and water in the pools of this structure, cool air is transferred from the wind catcher to the building. Oh God, I was wondering how genius Iranian architects were at that time. Wind catchers make the scenic city of Yazd full of charm and beauty. Wind catchers offer a sense of timeless beauty, and at the same time, they play a key role in making the interior spaces, cellars, and water reservoir cool. Though there are wind catchers in the world, especially in the West Asia region, never forget that these structures are exclusively Iranian.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to A Better You. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The unwillingness of prominent mainstream politicians to stand up to the racist Zionist movement is a depressingly familiar story. We saw how Israel apologists dominated and ultimately destroyed Jeremy Corbyn's prospects of becoming the British Prime Minister, despite his repeated efforts to appease his Zionist detractors. But Robert F. Kennedy, who's a progressive presidential hopeful in the United States of America, has gone considerably further down the same road to perdition. Kennedy has been striving to mollify his Zionist critics by repeatedly making servile statements about the Zionist colony and telling barefaced lies about the Palestinian struggle for freedom. We'll be discussing Kennedy's attempt to ingratiate himself with the pro-Israel lobby and why it's doomed to fail after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra, who's been looking at Kennedy's backstory.
Robert F. Kennedy is the son of an assassinated US senator and the nephew of an assassinated president of the US, John F. Kennedy. RFK is well known for his lack of trust in the US intelligence agencies. Considering the question marks surrounding both his father's and uncle's deaths, you can understand why. RFK has announced his intention to run for president of the United States in 2024. He has been outspoken about the US invasion of Iraq in 2003 and has had a clear-minded analysis of the NATO war against Russia in Ukraine. He has described the war as sacrificing the flower of Ukrainian youth in an abattoir of death and destruction for the geopolitical ambition of the neocons. In a clear contrast with other candidates for the presidency, Kennedy has stated his intention to de-escalate US imperial ambitions towards the People's Republic of China. Unfortunately, he has a significant blind spot for Palestine. Despite Kennedy being branded as anti-Semitic by smear merchants, he constantly sought to ingratiate himself with the Zionist lobby. Firstly, after stating his solidarity with Roger Waters, when the Pink Floyd musician was attacked by the lobby, Kennedy swiftly climbed down after being pressured by prominent Zionist lobbyists. RFK crudely referred to the resistant Palestinian city of Jenin as a bomb factory and waxed lyrical about the morality of the Israeli military. He has grown significantly close to Israel lobbyist Shmuley Botech, who heads an organization that regularly places full-page pro-Israel ads in newspapers like The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. Botech also claims to have been a spiritual leader to the late pop star and alleged pedophile Michael Jackson. RFK's key ally, Botech, is a close friend of Yair Netanyahu, the bratish son of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. When hosting Yair in conversation, Shmuley Botech pontificated at great length about his intense love for the senior Netanyahu. Interestingly, RFK has also recently sought the assistance of the Zionist Organizations of America by tapping the CEO of the lobby group, Mort Klein, to work for him as an advisor on Israel. Robert F. Kennedy may be independent on foreign policy, but he is captured on Palestine.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Max Blumenthal, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Max is a courageous investigative journalist, a groundbreaking author, and is the editor of Grey Zone News, which he founded in 2015. Earlier this month, he publicly took Robert Kennedy to task for his egregious remarks about Israel and Palestine in an interview with the US podcaster Jimmy Dore. Welcome to the show. David, say a bit about Kennedy's position on NATO's war in Ukraine.
So, I mean, his son actually went and fought in Ukraine, on the Ukrainian side, but he's been very critical of the war. I mean, you saw in the film there, he refers to it as an abattoir. And, of course, that's not in any way an exaggeration. If anything, it's a sort of polite way of saying the horror that's been going on during the counteroffensive, where the slaughter of Ukrainian forces has been immense. Piles and piles of destroyed Western equipment all over the front lines. So he's been very critical of that, and he's been critical of the role of NATO in starting and provoking the war, and indeed of prosecuting the war and the supply of all those billions of dollars. Is it billions of dollars now? Of weaponry and support from the West. So he's been, when he first started to say these things, I mean, there was a kind of ripple went round the kind of anti-war left, saying, well, this is really quite interesting, a candidate who's actually opposing the war in Ukraine. And, of course, that helped him to gain some kind of profile on the left, which, of course, has been subsequently dissipated somewhat.
Yes, indeed. Well, I started by asking Max, what explains Kennedy's position on Palestine?
Well, I wasn't even aware that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had a position on Palestine. It then emerged that he was vaguely pro-Israel, but throughout the month of May and early June, after he launched his campaign on a pro-peace platform, it wasn't really an emphasized component of his plank. Then he began to be accused of anti-Semitism, predictably, for issuing support for Roger Waters, who was under attack in Germany, because he is the world's leading celebrity advocate for the liberation of Palestinians from occupation and apartheid. I mean, how do you, you know, thank Roger Waters or show solidarity with Roger Waters on Twitter as a presidential candidate and not know that he supports Palestine? After he came under attack from people like the notorious race hustler and former reality show rabbi Shmuley Bhotia, RFK pleaded ignorance. I didn't know that Roger Waters had these positions, and I just was thanking him for the stand he took on COVID. But Roger Waters never took any stand against the COVID restrictions.
David, tell me about this Shmuley Bhotia that Kennedy's seems to have grown pretty close to.
Well, this is a really interesting guy. He's a guy who's written self-help sex books for Jews, and he's quite popular. He's got all sorts of ways of raising money. He actually was sent by the Rebbe of his order, and he comes from the Chabad sect, yes, which, as we've said on previous shows, is one of the sort of extremist pro-Zionist sects. We're involved, according to the Shin Bet, in 80% of price tag killings against the Palestinians in the settlements, in particular the Hilltop Youth. Yeah. So this is an extremist pro-Zionist sect which used to be anti-Zionist, but Shmuley was sent by the Rebbe, the head of the sect, who's now dead, to Oxford in England, where he set up this thing called the Chlachaim Society, which was a sort of student society where he involved non-Jews as well, but it was a sort of Jewish, mainly Jewish, but also non-Jewish society, and he had a whole lot of high-profile speakers come to it, including Zionists, but also some, American militarists and that kind of thing. Yeah. And there was, of course, a difficulty with that, because what happened was that he was using the money which was coming into the society, which was a charity, not part of the university, to pay his own mortgage. And so there was a question about fraud, and one of the Jewish papers actually investigated this and went to the police about it. And so he sort of departed under a cloud. He was blacklisted by the chief rabbi. And then he goes off to America to make his fortune, and there's been all sorts of allegations there about his dealings. And so it's a really strange character for RFK to be hitched up with, but he's hitched up with him to defend him against allegations of anti-Semitism. Yeah. So when he was accused of anti-Semitism, Rabbi Shmuley would come out and say, no, my friend RFK, and then they did this big video together, and RFK became, you know, decisively Zionist and started spouting all this, you know, Likud-like propaganda and talking points, which is really very disappointing to those on the left who said, oh, this could be an interesting candidate. So that's where he's got to, and that's the role that Shmuley has played from the Chabad sect.
Mm. Well, we know from the Jeremy Corbyn experience that tactic simply won't work. But anyway, time will tell on that. But I then asked Max what he thought the significance was of Robert Kennedy requesting the head of the Zionist Organization of America to advise him on Israel.
Well, I'm not a close friend of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but I have had a personal relationship with him. And I know other people closer to him who are supporters of the Palestinian struggle. One of them, Charles Eisenstein, is an advisor to RFK who is extremely disgusted with what Israel has been doing for the last 70 years. And apparently RFK wasn't listening to these people. He wasn't interested in what they had to say. And that speaks to the power of the Israel lobby over in American politics, of course. But RFK went further than other candidates who tend to be advised by AIPAC and the kind of foreign policy establishment that's based around think tanks like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was born out of AIPAC. He's speaking to people like Morton Klein. He's made Morton Klein his Israel policy advisor. And Morton Klein is someone who referred to Palestinians and other Arabs simply as filthy Arabs. He's never met a war against any Arab country he didn't like.
David, just say a bit more, will you, about what happened with regard to Robert F. Kennedy and his position on Roger Waters. Curious state of affairs there, wasn't it?
Well, so what happened was that he supported Roger Waters in a tweet, and then all hell broke loose from the pro-Israel lobby.
This was after Roger Waters' show, I think, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right, yes. He was accused of anti-Semitism, you know, by mendacious Zionist lobbyists.
Yes.
And he supported him, and then he deleted the tweet after immense pressure was clearly put upon him. And that's when he started to appear with this guy, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach.
Yeah.
And so that was the process. So it looked like he was, you know, again, it looked like he was doing something which is actually defending someone who's being smeared by the Zionists. And really very rapidly that was closed down. And he started being spouting quite different sounding ideas. Now, the interesting thing about all this is that he says this is the kind of thing which his father and JFK himself would have done, and they were always big supporters of Israel. But that doesn't really seem to be the case. In fact, it seems to be the case that back in the day, the RFK Senior was actually trying to make sure that the Zionist Organization of America, an organization which RFK is now taking advice from, was registered as a foreign agent of Israel.
Yes.
So that appeared, and there are other circumstances as well. There are other issues there about, for example, the Israelis' development of the nuclear weapons, which they'd done by stealing plutonium from America. There's all sorts of suggestions about that, about the role of the Kennedys in being critical of Israel. And he's now saying, well, no, my father was very supportive of Israel.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be the case. So that's very curious.
Yes, it is indeed. It's sort of a 180 degree volt face then, isn't it?
It would appear to be so. Yes.
Yeah.
Who knows what the rationale is. I mean, his campaign manager, Denis Kucinich, is a famous radical.
Yes.
And, you know, who knows what the calculations are.
Yeah.
People say, it's what they used to say about Tony Blair, isn't it? Oh, well, he's pretending not to be a radical. And when he gets into power, all things will change.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can speculate on what's happened there, but something very odd happened.
No, indeed. Well, when Jimmy Dore asked Robert Kennedy whether he would debate his views on Israel with Max Blumenthal, he agreed. So I asked Max if and when the debate was actually going to take place.
I highly doubt any debate will be happening, even though at the Iowa State Fair, when Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was asked about or sort of accused of anti-Semitism by some mainstream reporter, he decided to frame himself as not only not an anti-Semite, and he is not, there's really no basis for calling him that, but also someone who's accused, in his words, by the far left of being a Zionist, and therefore he is planning to debate me, Max Blumenthal. He referred to me as Matt Blumenthal in a few weeks. And this was just a bizarre statement because his communications director had told me that they would not do any debates with anyone except for Joe Biden because Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a serious Democratic primary candidate.
David, I mean, how do you think Kennedy would fare in that debate if it goes ahead with Max?
Well, I mean, Max and Aaron Mattei, also of the Grey Zone, have already systematically deconstructed.
Oh, yes, yes. So people can watch that on YouTube. It's very, very interesting.
Aaron Key's account. And his stuff is slightly embarrassing. It's an embarrassing Hasbarist, pro-Likud talking points. And you know, Max is a well-known journalist. Max spent time in Gaza under assault, wrote a book about it, did a documentary on it. And he, you know, famously, he used to be a Zionist, right? And he left the faith, if you like, if you can put it that way, and became an anti-Zionist. And so he is well able for that, as is indeed Aaron Mattei. You know, I don't know if Aaron used to be a Zionist. He may have been, but he comes from that kind of a background. So, you know, that is a debate which would be well worth seeing. And it's not a question of who would win. It's a question of, whether RFK thinks he should just take the punches to the jaw he's going to get and move on with the campaign, or whether it would look better for him just not to bother with the interview at all.
No, indeed. I mean, as I was saying in the introduction, though, certainly Kennedy has gone much further down that road to perdition that Jeremy Corbyn trod, and I don't think it's going to do him any good, and he's made himself look foolish, actually, I think, with some of the stuff he's been saying. But anyway, I would advise people, if you've not seen it, to watch that debate, which you can get on YouTube and Rumble. Anyway, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment. After this report, contrasting the views of Cornel West, who's another US presidential candidate, with those of Robert Kennedy.
Another figure of interest to watch in the run-up to the 2024 U.S. presidential elections is the academic and political firebrand Dr. Cornel West. He has stated his intention to run for president for the Green Party. Dr. West has generally been a critical voice against the U.S. empire in the public sphere for many years. However, while demonstrating opposition to the NATO war machine, he has also swallowed key aspects of U.S. propaganda by echoing some of the hollow claims against Russia and Iran from time to time. On Palestine, however, Dr. West is far more on point than RFK. He was previously a teacher at the prestigious Harvard University. However, when the time came, he was refused tenure and given very little explanation as to why. West argued it was due to his steadfast support of the Palestinian people in their epic battle against Zionist settler colonialism. West struck back at Harvard, stating, "I'm not a backdoor-going kind of brother. They picked the wrong black man. If I can't be a free black man in the way in which I can preserve my self-respect, then I'm not going to be in a place like that." A Palestine declassified investigation later revealed some very interesting links between Harvard and the Zionist regime. Of course, it is known that convicted pedophile and Israeli intelligence asset Jeffrey Epstein had long funded Harvard University. Epstein also used his influence to cancel a lecture by biologist Robert Trivers at Harvard due to his pro-Palestinian positions. The Palestine declassified investigation revealed the administration and funders list of Harvard University to be littered with Israel lobbyists. Dr. Cornel West only recently stated that Palestine is the more moral question of our generation. While he will not be the next U.S. president, he will certainly widen the conversation about Palestine and its liberation in the U.S. mainstream.
David, just say a bit more, will you, about what happened with Cornel West at Harvard?
So, as the film showed there, I mean, part of the reason that he wasn't given tenure was his views on Palestine and his support for Palestinian rights. It wasn't the only thing. I mean, he's also, of course, a trenchant critic of the marketization and commercialization of higher education, something which has been happening in the US as well as in the UK and many other Western countries. So he has been a critic of the way in which universities have increasingly moved away from the public ideal of education and towards being businesses who get funding from external sources. And of course, the increase in funding from external sources means that external sources can be more influential. And of course, many of the funding sources, as the investigation revealed, for Harvard have included high-profile Zionist funders who fund other organizations like the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces and all sorts of organizations like that, as you would expect. Now, of course, that kind of funding relationship, it doesn't always have a straightforward relationship to hiring and firing, but it can do. And we've already shown on the show some time ago the case of Kenneth Roth, who was first of all rejected from a post and then reinstated after a huge campaign to get him reinstated. And part of that was to do with the influence of Zionists in Harvard in trying to make sure that critics of Palestine don't get jobs, don't get tenure, are kept out or marginalised. And that's the way it works.
Well, I then asked Max about what the Green Party candidates who've previously run for president have stood for and how they've actually fared in the presidential elections.
Well, the Green Party is a victim of the American propaganda model and the inverted totalitarian model of American democracy, which seeks to achieve a preordained result in favor of the political and financial establishment behind the guise of democracy. And that is why the two-party system exists.
David, the last report there mentioned the Epstein relationship with Harvard. But what other links have you come across?
So there are lots of these, but some of the biggest ones, for example, Thomas Kaplan, who is a key person in the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the most elite U.S. foreign policy think tank in the U.S., and he's given money to the organization, mm-hmm. and through his late mother's foundation, he's also donated to the Temple Institute, which is an organization dedicated to effectively undermining the Al-Aqsa Mosque and taking control of the Al-Aqsa Mosque from Muslims, which is, of course, the second most holy place in Islam. And, of course, there's Leslie Wexner, who has also been given significant sums of money there. And the program he's established has featured all sorts of people from the Shin Bet, from the Israeli military, who've come to Harha to present their views. And then, of course, there's Aidan Offer, who we've mentioned before on this show, whose family have this shipping company, which has been used by the Mossad to run spies into Iran in contravention of the sanctions. And, of course, that was how it became revealed, because it was being shown that this Israeli company was breaching sanctions on Iran. But actually what was happening was that they were running Mossad agents into Iran. Presumably, they were engaged in the assassination of the nuclear scientist in Iran. Right. So there's all those kinds of connections. Sure. And this is kind of standard for elite universities in the US.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Max Blumenthal, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis. So until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now. And now we can do the...
In the limelight.
Many Mo'oi survivors say the U.S. government response to the recent wildfire in the island has been inadequate and slow. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the